couple of minutes past half 12, so I suggest we get started. Miles has flashed up the privacy notice. Thank you, Miles. Thank you for joining us, everyone. Hello, welcome. For those of you who've been on these sessions a couple of times now, you know how it works. Pretty informal. We'll have a topic for the week. We'll chat about it. We'll see what's been in the news. Anything we've been working on of interest, myself, Ollie Rea, and I'm joined, obviously, as ever, by my two esteemed colleagues, Phil Brining and Dave Holmes, who will say hi in just a minute, although they have introduced themselves already and Phil's doorbell in the process. As we always do, we record these sessions just so that people can access them afterwards. We put them out in the form of a podcast on Spotify and other channels, and Miles can provide you with a link to that if you need it. Privacy notice on screen now. If you've got any issues with that, let us know. So, Phil, Dave, say hi.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello. Hello. Thank you, Ollie. Somebody mentioned the other day that Dave, Phil and Ollie must be the DPO, outsourced DPO.
Oh, very nice.
Oh, yeah. I think it was Dave Hendry, actually. He's a quick-witted, isn't he, Dave? Sometimes. Right, so what are we talking about today then, Ollie? I believe we're talking about environmental information regulations and the Freedom of Information Act and the GDPR and requests for information. Is that the topic of choice?
Quite right, and thank you for prompting me to introduce the topic because I hadn't yet. Yeah, so we're doing requests for information just quite broadly, and that covers, as you've mentioned there, a range of things. So whether that's, you know, just subject access requests, or whether it expands to the Freedom of Information Act and any requests made under that. And also something which is perhaps a little bit more unfamiliar to some of us, although those in local government and public authorities might know a bit more about it, the Environmental Information Regulations. So we'll take a look at all those in due course, but let's take a look at the news, first of all. So is there anything that you two have come across this week that you found particular interest? I've got a couple bits and pieces, but I'll let you both go first.
Well, I've got a few things, but I read a really interesting article. I've read a few actually about targeted advertising in cars. So advertising in cars is like the next holy grail or next thing that the advertisers are focusing on. So this is both audio ads and you know, video ads. And it just got me thinking, you know, some of it might be useful, you know, where's the cheapest petrol, you know, I don't know about you, I always come off the motorway, I'm a, you know, a bit of a skinflint, I hate paying £1.45 a litre for petrol, and I know you can go to Tesco's and buy it for £1.19 or something, so I always come off the motorway and fill it with petrol, but if you could, you know, get relevant and useful ads like that could be useful. I just wondered what happened when you sold your car, you know, and what, you know, where is this information stored, or if you hire a car, or, you know, if you've got it could be embarrassing if you're going off with a load of passengers and you've got ads for personal services, for instance, popping up, you know, you're now going past all these various things. So I think there's quite a lot in there. I wondered how you would switch it off, and maybe that would be a paid service as it is in apps. You know, you've got to pay to stop the advertising coming through. But that's it. I'd not really thought, because I haven't got any modern cars.
It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because firstly, if it pops up on your, because some cars have an inbuilt sat nav, so if it pops up on your sat nav screen, that kind of thing, would it be deemed distracting? Because you're not meant to be playing with your phone whilst you're driving. And would there be that distracting element of it? And if they're targeting your ads, then is it your car kind of reading what your phone's doing, or picking up on internet use through your phone, and then starting displaying targeted ads from where you've been looking through other or connected mobile devices? Which would be quite interesting to see how they would do that, firstly, and secondly, whether you're in a car with somebody, whether you want particular ads shown at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to suggest that it's not phone based. It's kind of, you know, the car itself is a great big computer on wheels, and it knows where you are, and it understands your driving habits, and it understands where you've been or where the car's been, and, you know, it's got a whole range of data that it's collecting, and that kind of, because it's saying that the car itself would have to then have driver profiles or passenger profiles.
That's what I mean. In order to target the ads, so yeah. how does a car know? Apart from saying, ooh, you're 5 miles away from McDonald's, if you want to pop in, you'll get 10% off, that kind of thing, which isn't really targeted to the individual. It's just targeted to the time of day and the fact that you're passing your local McDonald's.
Well, it's whether it would say, for you, it would say there's a McDonald's, and for me, it would say there's a KFC. So that's probably the extent to which you could get targeting, you know, but you might go deep in that. But if you've got multiple people in the car, again, you know, if it's device based, whose device is going to be prevalent? And that was quite interesting. Yeah, that was quite interesting,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Take police to the first exit of the roundabout for Phil's dinner, and then take the second right for Dave's.
Yeah, you spend all day getting where you're going, yeah.
But it is interesting, anyway, actually, joking aside, it is interesting what happens to all that information. Where is it stored? Where is it held? Who has access to it? That kind of thing, especially if you retain the car or sell the car or move. Because I certainly know from my car, it emails me every... Well, I suppose it is actually the car doing it. But I get an email from the car every month telling me the amount of miles I've driven, the airs in my tyres, the fuel's in the tank, when its service is due. So it's kind of an extension to that, I would have thought. How the car's connected as a kind of an internet of thing device, isn't it?
Yeah, and that information could be actually in the vehicle itself, or it could be in a database for the manufacturer maintains. I don't really know. I mean, quite interesting to have a look at that, to be honest. Quite fascinating to have a look at where the data actually is.
I'll have to email Vauxhall and say, how do you know this about me? Once we get it, we'll have another chat about it.
Yeah, so what have you seen? I saw the ICO's put out the new some guidance on political campaign advice, which I thought was really useful, actually, not just for political campaigning. Again, that might affect or be relevant to local authorities. But what was really interesting is it goes into a lot of detail on PECA guidance. So towards the back end, it's looking at profiling, it's looking at scraping data off the internet and reusing it, it's looking at use of data brokers, you know, these kind of practices obviously are going on, and now the ICO has come out with a very useful piece of advice. None of it is particularly, you know, any different. The PECA advice isn't any different. In fact, it reinforces the stuff that's in the PECA guidance, which is good. But you know, it was interested in these terms, flugging, sugging and mugging, all these terms for different direct marketing activities. Oh, crikey. I was interested that the kind of dear occupier letters are also direct marketing if you know the name of the occupier, but you choose not to use it.
Yeah, that was always in the old guidance and direct marketing as well. So when I was working in the charity sector, and they were kind of using it as a way to, well, can we communicate with people without using their names? And you kind of go, but it is personal information. If you hold the address and on your CRM system, you know who lives at the address. You can't just kind of go dear occupier to try and get around people opting out from hearing from you.
Yeah. So that to me was the most, I don't know if you saw that, Dave, but that was the most useful.
I did. There was one bit in it that I thought was a little confusing, but I don't think it was the ICO guidance. I think it was a court case in relation to, I'm just trying to think, where is it? I think it's probably not even political takeaway. So I think it's possibly looking at another case with funds for you. But we'll come on to that in a minute if you like. I was just trying to find the parts, that's why I'm waffling a little bit. There's a little bit I found confusion about the Court of Appeals determination over whether the GDPR applied.
Will you have a look for that? So another thing I was quite interested in on this, it gives some quite good examples. So we've been through this with a couple of clients actually, where they're doing profiling. And you know what constitutes automated processing, and from memory the client was telling me, well, I have a person who sits at a computer and plows through, you know, with Excel, you know, filtering and sorting, and we don't think that's automated processing. And I said, well, I think it probably is, but the interesting thing about this particular advice is it's got about seven examples of what effects of automated processing are considered to be legal or similar effects. You know, none of them are actually legal effects, but they're all, you know, of similar significance. So that's really good, again, not necessarily for political campaign, but to take it out of that context and say, right, if these kind of decisions are similarly significant to legal decisions, then I can probably take that and apply it to kind of other things that we're doing in a different context. So I thought that was a really useful aspect of it. It covers off cookies as well, some areas of cookies and pixel tracking and things, Ollie, your favourite your favourite subject.
My favourites indeed. Not to steer the conversation away from this, because I feel like Dave will have found his passage by now, hopefully. But in terms of internet tracking, Rick in the chat has raised a very, very interesting point this week, and I was going to come on to it, Rick, which is an aspect of the Investigatory Powers Act coming into force. But we'll get onto that very shortly. Dave,
saw that,
you found the bit you were looking for.
Yeah, it relates to Phones for You and a case that went to court. I don't know if anybody else caught it, in relation to accessing private mobile devices that may contain work information or messages for work purposes, that kind of thing. So if you've got a kind of private chat group and they're discussing about business, work business stuff on there, you've got private emails or your private email account that you've got work emails on, you're communicating for work purposes, being accessible. And there was a court case that said, well, it probably will be accessible because it's still under the control of the organisation, that kind of thing. And it kind of then broke it down a bit further with kind of the decision of the court, and the Court of Appeal got involved and bits and pieces in there. And the bit that kind of confused me, rather, I maybe just misread that, I'm just kind of trying to read it back, but it's asking whether it's proportionate, what is a proportionate approach to searching of personal devices. Justice Roth ordered the defendants to write to the relevant custodians to request they voluntarily produce their personal IT devices for IT consultants to engage with. So they're looking at this proportionality, kind of going, actually, we've got this third party that's going to do the review, going to search the phone. If they find anything relevant, then that will come back. Anything isn't, then it's not disclosed to lawyers or anybody else, in order to try and maintain or to give a degree of privacy to yourselves, so information other than what they're trying to look for would be disclosed, in that kind of sense. And the information that we're trying to find related to work-related communications and to around the employee's business, for example. So that kind of all went to court, and they're kind of saying, can we force people, can't we force people, that kind of thing. And the Court of Appeal was also said, we're unconcerned by the GDPR because it is clear, this is what the court said, it is clear that any data processing is undertaken by the IT consultants will indeed be either one, with the consent of the custodians.
Yeah, I saw that.
I'm thinking, well, how can it be consent if you tell them you've got to supply it? And then number two, or it'll be necessary for the IT consultant as a data controller. And I was thinking, well, how can the IT consultant be a data controller if he's appointed solely for looking and then handing the information over? Surely that makes him a processor.
And I saw both those, Dave. Yeah.
And this is coming from the Court of Appeal.
I know. Bizarre, isn't it? I mean, I thought, hey, I don't get this at all. The other aspect, go on.
I was going to say, I was following it, thinking, well, I actually get the fact that you've isolated. You're kind of doing what you can to maintain privacy, trying to give respect to privacy by saying, look, neither the lawyers, neither parties interested, nor the organisation is going to be there. We're going to get somebody completely independent just to do some search terms. Anything that comes up on these search terms will be disclosed. And you're kind of going, well, I can see the kind of proportionality element. I can see how you're trying to address the privacy. Then I hit this bit about the Court of Appeal, and I've just lost it on that. But I was thinking, how can that be consent?
Well, it can't be consent. I mean, I thought exactly the same. I thought that cannot be consent. But this, I mean, it's relevant, this case, I think, for today's discussion, because, you know, this was a question for information, admittedly under court proceedings, wasn't it, rather than for like a subject access request or anything like that. But, you know, the court has ruled that the devices of former employees and employees are caught by this particular request for information, you know, for court purposes. Which is interesting, particularly for WhatsApp, and electronic messages. And there's some interesting aspect to that. That was one of them, Dave. But I was interested in also this fiduciary duty to the defendant at common law. So, you know, almost like there's a fiduciary duty in common law for you to supply your device anyway to the defendant, because, you know, it's a common law fiduciary duty. So I wasn't entirely sure about that. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that. And the other thing is that I think in the original judgment, the judge said, but of course these individuals, employees, former employees, don't have to comply. So again, the Court of Appeal has picked that up and it basically said, well, we're not sure what would happen then, because we'd probably then have to get involved in some sort of order to make them comply. So that's kind of left that aspect hanging here. Do you have to supply your devices or not?
And that's really confusing, because it's, like I say, it's not a request for a DSL that's been challenged. It's a court order saying we need to ask these people for access to the phones. So surely if they go no, then is that not contempt of court? Or is it not actually a court order? It's just kind of a recommendation.
It was the whole thing was a little bit bizarre. But I mean, I think relevant to this, because I was thinking, well, can we draw parallels out of this? Can we assume, is this case law adding to the volume of information we've got about proportionality? And is it adding to the wealth of information we've got about, the other private devices and messages between employees on devices relating to work? And are that, they're caught by the SAR, subject to request provisions.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at as well. I was thinking it certainly adds, if nothing else other than persuasive guidance, that if you've got employees using WhatsApp to communicate about work purposes, but outside of organisational controls in that sense, that it could well be subject to a SAR, and you could well end up finding yourself having to ask for access to those communications.
Yeah.
But whether you need to rely on the court to enforce access to private mobile devices and such forth may well add a different element to the SAR process.
Yeah, but it's to say the disclosure review should be done by qualified solicitors rather than by any employees or by some specialist IT firm. So again, they're saying, well, this is impartial, it's independent, it seems proportional. And you can always pull some other interesting things out of these transcripts. Usually, the transcript here says that defendants can't rely on the inseparability of irrelevant material as a basis for declining to permit inspection of devices. So the fact it's complicated isn't a strong argument. The fact it's complicated is irrelevant. If you can't separate relevant and irrelevant material, don't worry about it, because we're going to give it to a special third party to do that for us, kind of thing. But I thought the phones view Court of Appeal case was really interesting, for those reasons. Did you see that, Ollie?
You sent it to me this morning, but I've not had a chance to read it. No,
right.
But sounds like I'm gonna have to now.
Oh, you'll have to read that, definitely. Yeah.
You should have read it, Ollie. You've had an hour or so to read that.
I've been on calls all morning, Kath.
I'm just laughing at Phil saying, "Have you read it?" That's what I'm laughing at.
Right.
No, I tell you what, I have been reading about a bit though this morning, which is just to come back to it, what Rick had put in the chat before. And I mean, Rick, feel free to dive on and talk about it if you want, if you know more about it than I do, which no doubt you do. But is the trialing of one of these Investigatory Powers Act powers, and the fact that basically the internet provider's been in on it, so they're trying the technology behind it, and it's basically this whole process whereby create internet connection records, which compile the metadata of your browsing, and it's all for surveillance purposes, which is very interesting, relatively controversial, as Rick points out in his comment, whether this might undermine our adequacy decision. I mean, we've said this for a while now, haven't we, in the conversations of whether we might actually get adequacy. Things like RIPA, Investigatory Powers Act, are going to be the spanner in the works, really, if anything's going to be. But certainly interesting. I'd like to know a little bit more about the process behind it, but it's all pretty secretive at the minute.
It's just a trial, though, isn't it?
It is just a trial, yeah. But apparently it's been going on for 2 years now, covertly, exactly. So we'll have to see what comes of that. But no, very interesting nonetheless. And the other thing I saw just literally about 10 minutes before this call started, I caught it as I was browsing, is the European Data Protection Board have just published guidelines on virtual voice assistants. So your Alexas and your whatever they're called, Cortana, OK Google, all those sort of devices. It looks very, very interesting. I've had a very quick flick through it. Lots of detail in there. So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that, because it's something which often comes up. And, when people sort of say, oh, do they listen all the time? It's like, well, yeah, clearly they're always listening. Otherwise, how do you think they work? But no, definitely looks like something to get into.
Yeah. So what have you, anything else, Dave? I mean, the other thing I noticed was the ICO fined a Leeds generation company who basically supply Avon, you know, Avon Calling, the pharmaceutical, the not pharmaceutical, the cosmetics firm with Leeds. And it's quite, again, interesting to have a look through. And this is something, again, we need to send out to some of our clients, Ollie, because it's exactly, you know, up there, you know, in terms of relevance. It's absolutely, you know, relevant to inform some of the decisions. But, you know, again, we're being told that, you know, due diligence of putting a contractual obligation to TPS data and supply, you know, consented data isn't due diligence. Due diligence is getting out and testing it. Due diligence is, you know, making sure that you're relying on your work. And the fact that other people are doing it and lawyers have allegedly advised those other people that it's legal, again, doesn't cut it as due diligence. There's some interesting stuff. And then also, you know,
a point on that. I don't know if that was also covered by the political campaigning thing, wasn't it, with the ICO when they're talking about purchasing cold data from data providers about what does due diligence look like, and whether, and I think they gave the example, whereas if you went, well, is it all opted in, and the data provider went, yeah, don't worry about it, and that sunk into a contract saying, yes, it's fine, don't worry about it, and they didn't take it any further, that you'd actually be found you'd have failed due diligence because you can't just take their word for it in that sense.
Yeah, that's what happened here with these leads. And also, because there was like 457 different organisations, you know, listed as they might receive marketing information from, again, unsurprisingly, the ICO said, well, that's not specific consent. It's not properly informed. It's a confusing privacy notice. So you're kind of between the rock and the hard place. And, you know, you've got to try to provide information, but when you try and provide it, then you're told that's too complicated, it's too confusing. I mean, it's a really difficult balance to achieve, isn't it? I guess you need some more layering of privacy information and some just-in-time privacy information, maybe putting on the top of that. But okay, again, another interesting thing came out of the political campaign work, and this was also, if you're kind of collecting leads from Facebook or from your LinkedIn page, then you've got to make sure you've put up or provided an Article 14 compliant privacy notice. You know, so after the event, we've got your information, you know, from the Electoral Register in the case of political campaigning, and this is what we're going to do with it. So
I found that kind of a bit sitting on the fence with the ICO, to be fair, because I kind of going, if you put it in the public domain, it's in the public domain, but was it kind of put there for you to take for marketing purposes? And they don't fall down on either side, do they? It's in the public domain, but did they put it there for you to pick up and start badging them on about which political party do you want to support or not? And then they kind of eased off, but they're kind of still in this kind of fence position going, well, actually, doesn't mean that you can just scrape information just because it's on a public platform and then start using that for political campaign purposes.
Yeah, we talked about this a few weeks ago, saying if you do obtain information, you know, from whatever source and then provide a privacy notice under Article 14, does that constitute lawful processing, or does the fact it's probably being collected unfairly in the very first place, does that scupper the whole, you know, down the downstream use of that data? I don't think it's clear, is it?
I don't know whether you'd want to kind of take it a step further by going, well, look, actually, if you're an individual and you've got a Facebook page or a LinkedIn page, so it's on a social media platform, but you've got your settings such that it's basically public to any geoblogs looking at it, then fair enough, you're making your data public to everybody, and if people picked up to use against you, that's your choice, because you could have configured it to restrict it, whereas you could probably say it feels a bit more intrusive if somebody's got a closed account saying, well, I'm on Facebook by anyone close friends to be on there, I don't want to be seen by everybody, LinkedIn, I don't want to be seen by anybody, only the people I want to link with in that sense, and then maybe scraping from circumstances, and that would maybe seem inappropriate, would certainly seem difficult to align to privacy expectations and requirements because you've got a closed account.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to then go back and check, haven't you? Because people might change their status or whatever it's called in Facebook, and you might find that, you know, at one point it was public and now they've closed it down. But that requires an overview and audit regime.
But really interesting point, though, isn't it? Because if you had a closed account but I knew 500 people, is that in essence making it public despite the fact that it's closed? So is there an arbitrary figure at which you can say it's closed and over which you then become public just to, through sheer volume? Very similar, and I know it's only a very moot point and I can possibly be quite academic, but same with litigation and legal privilege, where privilege exists until it's waived and you can kind of inadvertently waive it by disclosing it to too many people.
Yeah, and I think that's a very small number of people, isn't it, in that case?
It is, yeah.
You can shoot yourself in the foot by disclosing it to a, you know, handful of people. I think again depends on who they are and what role they have, but you could, you know, one or two people could probably throw a spanner in those particular ways. There's interesting again in this final point I want to make on this Leeds this Avon was it Leeds Work Limited, was that they said that they were a member of Shield and use that as an indicator of their compliance. Now, this is the scheme. I can't find it anywhere. I've had a search for it. This is a scheme operated by a law firm who seem to do GDPR compliance audits. And if they're deemed to be compliant, then they're entered into a scheme. Now, I was really interested in that, fascinated in that, because of all the work we're doing, you know, digging around on you know, our DPO services and our audit services, and you know, and being, you know, really worried that are we doing, you know, a good enough job? Let's say we're on a day a month kind of a service, or even, you know, what we're suggesting, like a couple of hours per week with a client. Is that enough to monitor compliance or advise them, you know, under the responsibilities of a DPO, or you know? But this scheme, yeah, I just wanted to find out, you know, exactly what it was and what they did. But I was interested that was there as well. But it seemed to come off quite badly, that scheme, in here in this report.
I can't say I've heard of that scheme. I'd have to look into it a bit further.
Yeah, no, I was hoping to find out more about it. So was there anything else before we've got to get into the subject matter we're due to be talking about, haven't we? Is that anything else? There's quite a few other things I noticed as well in the news, but it's probably time to move on, isn't it?
Yeah, we could always add them to the end if we find we've got a very short discussion about FOIA and information, environmental information rights. In that sense, we can either add them to the end or cover them in the next radio session, which is next week, isn't it?
Yeah. So, Olive, anything else for FIMO? Should we press on? I'm not usurping your chairing today, by the way. I'm just.
No, don't you worry. Don't you worry. Let's press on. Let's get into it.
So we said we would talk about requests for information made under the FOIA, the EIR and the GDPR. So I think probably very quick, I haven't seen the profile of who's on the call, but very quick review of the EIR and the FOIA and, you know, who it covers and what it covers. But there are three different regimes entirely. And so what I tried to do is find out some statistics on the numbers of different types of requests. And I thought naively that I might be able to find something on FOIA and EIR, but I couldn't. You know, the closest I found was the central government produces overall statistics, but I couldn't find anything above that. I couldn't find anything the ICO was compiling. But maybe there's no stats because there's no requirement to you know, compile that register and forward it onto the ICO. But it would be useful to know, wouldn't it, how many requests there are and how they're dealt with.
I think it'd be quite interesting, yeah. I think it'd be to see kind of the nature of the request as well, to see where they're breaking down, because it's you would have thought, well, it's collation's an issue, but because of the way FOIA works with this kind of, in essence, publication scheme, you'd have thought it might have been useful to have that kind of recorded, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, central government, for example, in 2019 received 49,000 freedom information requests, which is 1% down on the previous year, and only 1,647 requests under the EIR, which is 12% up on last year. So again, I think that's probably our experience, isn't it, as well, Dave, that we get a few cases for, you know, helping people with the FOIA, but very, very rarely come across the EIR, do we?
I've not really come across it. I've come across it from studying the EIR, and I understand it affects, and we'll look at it later, some potentially whether you are or whether you're not caught as a registered social housing provider, and the are we not kind of scenarios going on. But I've not seen any rights actually exercised under EIR.
No, very, very rarely. And I wonder if, and feel free to jump in here, chaps, if you feel otherwise, but I wonder if that's possibly to do with the way in which it's interpreted. I was looking at the ICO's website about this earlier as a bit of prep, and sort of comparing the guides for rights requests on the GDPR, freedom of information requests, and environmental information requests. And the thing that I found quite strange almost about the EI is the approach to it from the ICO in terms of their guidance seem to be far more, I don't know, potentially like laid back. It was all sort of, you should just deal with this, you know, in your general course of business, you know, respond to questions. It seemed far less rigid potentially than the other two. I don't know if that came across to either of you, but that maybe it's just me, but the way in which I read it, it seemed far less, yeah, stringent, which is potentially the reason that it's reflected in the way in which we come across it. It just seems to say, you know, if you get a question about something which is clearly environmental information, then just respond to it, essentially. I don't know if, yeah, as I say, whether that was reflected to either of you.
I didn't get the sense the ICO was laid back about it. What about you, Dave?
Not necessarily laid back. I think the route to the both of them's got a different track of how they come about. So the FOIA was just UK law, isn't it? But the EIR has actually come from a European directive in that sense. But I just think it's possibly just lesser known. I think people who get freedom of information, people who just go, well, I need access to decision making by an organisation, I'll do it in the FOIA. I don't think environmental information regulations have got the awareness that FOIA may have as a consequence.
Well, do you think it's confusing that they're called the Freedom of Information Environmental Information Regulations? Well, that's the title on the document, isn't it?
It's how I'm talking about. I don't think it helps because you've also got the Protection of Freedoms Act, haven't you? There's some protection, something or other, and I think it's we just can't assume people understand which bits of the law they're looking at. But I think the title Freedom of Information makes people think, well, that's the one I'm using in order to obtain access to something, because it just kind of makes a bit more sense than environmental information regulations means what in its title, whereas freedom information maybe suggests that there's a little bit more scope for normal geoblogs to use it.
Well,
I was just going to say, sorry, that's probably quite a good point, because one of the things we see the most are subject access requests incorrectly referred to as freedom information requests, saying I want a copy of my tenancy file or whatever it may be, I'm putting in a freedom information request. So yeah, I think that's probably quite a good point on that front. Sorry, Phil.
I'll just say that I think we probably at this point need to reflect on Tony Blair's view. I mean, he was obviously championing the Freedom of Information Act before he was the Prime Minister. And then, you know, in his memoirs, he says, "You idiot, you naive, foolish, irresponsible nincompoop. There is really no description of stupidity, no matter how vivid, that is adequate. I quake at the imbecility of it." You know what he's referring to? Freedom of Information Act.
And so, there's me thinking you were talking about the trying to find weapons of mass destruction in a desert.
No, this he considers to be his biggest mistake as Prime Minister in politics, according to his memoirs.
Quite the statement, isn't it?
Well, it is, isn't it? Do you think that they're you know, do you agree with him? Do you think it's irresponsible, naive, foolish? I mean, there's a lot of the time, you know, the FOIA is misused. I mean, there's no if somebody as they do, you know, write to all the councils asking them how much you spend on light bulbs a year, and then they start selling them LED bulbs. You know, there's nothing to stop that commercial use of the information that comes out of requests.
Yeah. I quite like the essence of what FOIA is trying to achieve. I quite like the fact that with information you can hold organisations to account, and that's similar with the environmental information regulations. They're there so you can hold organisations to account for the environmental impact that they're going to have from whatever they're doing, in that kind of sense, as a very kind of top level. So I like the fact that it empowers people. It's kind of going, look, we're here, we're possibly getting a boatload of public money, we're going to dig up something or other and stick something else on it, and as a consequence of that, you're entitled to hold us to account for that. So I do quite like the essence of what it's actually there to achieve and what it's actually trying to deliver in that sense, from a point of being open and the point of accountability.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I think that the spirit of it is good, but when it was enacted, I think there's mixed views as to it. Either goes too far or don't go far enough, depending on which side you were on, really, of the right to information, etc., or not.
Well, I think so, but I mean, you're never going to get a clear ground for everybody. You're going to get people saying, "Well, I want the right to decision making," and I wouldn't necessarily got the right to the decision making whilst the decision's being made, because you could argue, well, you're entitled to make a decision in a bubble where you've got relevant advisors, relevant people all coming to a decision. Why would you want 60 million people in the UK all having a pop at the actual decision-making power? But once the decision's been made, you can still be held to account for that part of it. So I think it all depends on where you're coming from. It's from the point of, well, actually, I want to be involved prior to that. I want to know when the discussion's happening, what's going on. You kind of go, well, maybe that's a bit too far. Because otherwise you could actually hamper the development and hamper the delivery of anything through constantly having to second guess and justify what people are going to be asking you.
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting facts that have been revealed by Under the Foyer. Again, I don't know if you've had a look at this, but you know, do you remember the MPs and ministers claiming thousands of pounds on taxes and expenses for travel? I think the 5.9 million pounds in expenses for travel. So that there's some quite interesting facts that have been brought out, through FOIA requests, and the government agreeing to a 1.5 million bailout of one of the most troubled schools in its academies program. Again, I remember this just before the 2005 general election. So it makes you wonder who's thinking up, well, what should we ask? You know, the press, you know, we want a decent story. Let's think of something and, you know, put in some FOIA requests and dig around and put a story together. 74 police officers serving with the Metropolitan Police have criminal records, again, according to one of the interesting facts revealed by the FOIA. Sorry, David.
Yeah, no, I don't necessarily think it's wrong in order to use FOIA to try and find a story, as long as what you're representing is actually accurate and you're not trying to be misleading, which the press can quite often get involved with in that sense. So I think as long as you're accurate with your reporting and you're not misleading in that sense, and you probably, even arguably, and I don't know how you're going to control it, you're not doing it for personal gain or financial gain. So you're not kind of highlighting, I don't know, that 50% of houses haven't got additional loft space insulation, and I just happen to have a load if you'd like some.
Yeah, but it's, you know, is it a good use of public resources to be, you know, finding this information out and providing it? If it's a publication scheme thing, then fine. But if it's a request for information, is it a good use of public resources to be, spending time pulling some of this information out and providing it in the public domain?
Well, that's quite an interesting concept, isn't it? Because I wonder how many public authorities, or those that are caught by Schedule 1 of FOIA, have actually changed practices to try to avoid information being accessible. So, for example, if you're not under an obligation to create information, well, what do we do to make sure that we create as little as possible?
Yeah, so I'm just opening up the chat and having a look at there's a few chats in people that are kind of seem to be staggered at Tony Blair's outburst, but yeah, it's true. Apparently the Scottish, I'm just having a look for that now, the Scottish Information Commissioner does provide statistics on the FOIA request and IR request. I'll have a look at those in a second. Do we need to cover off, Dave, Ollie, you know, what's covered and who's covered? So one of our areas we work in now, social housing, you know, there's been three, as far as I know, different rulings. One, I think the first one that they were caught by the EIR. I mean, I can't imagine that they're not. I went to see a housing association in Glasgow a few years ago, and they were doing a massive district heating scheme, which involved ground source heat pumps and the like. So I said to them, you know, this surely must be caught under the EIR. They were in Glasgow, so obviously caught by Scottish, the Scottish regulator. But so the first decision was, yes, they're caught by the EIR. Then the second decision was, no, they're not caught by the EIR. And then the latest one, the Richmond Housing Partnership, was it, where they say they're not caught by them again. So that's the latest position, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because when you start talking about are you caught by the EIRs or not, I think people go, well, we're not caught by FOIA. Without kind of possibly considering whether the EIRs will include FOIA, because it certainly refers to Schedule 1, but whether it's a little bit broader than FOIA. And I think if people kind of go Schedule 1, that's it, and not going any further, then they seem to think, well, if we're not FOIA, then we're free to roam with everything else. But the Richmond Housing Partnership was quite an interesting, because there's a couple, wasn't there? They were using the test that was laid down by the European Court of Justice in the Fish Legal kind of series of cases.
Yeah.
And you've got to decide whether the organisation in question provides services of a public interest, or in the public interest, should I say, rather than of a public interest, services in the public interest, and then whether that organisation has any special powers over and above what may be available under private law. So it was kind of looking at whether, because I think Popper Housing Association was the other one that was held, and one was held to be caught by EIRs because we're deemed to have a special power not available to under private law, because they've got the ability to acquire land under Section 34 of the Housing Associations Act. So the fact that popular housing was caught, but Richmond wasn't, leads you to think, well, why wasn't Richmond housing not considered as courts? And it would appear, just from my basic interpretation, that Richmond never actually said they got the ability to compulsory purchase, and just relied over focus on the fact that the only thing we've got that's different to anybody else is the ability to apply for antisocial behaviour orders. And they kind of went, well, that's nothing to do with information regulations, don't worry about it, you're not courts. And I just think it was two cases that has then kind of left in the position of, well, our housing associations caught by the EIRs are not, and because Richmond's the latest, that would at the moment say that you're not.
Yeah, there's it on the chat here. Ian is saying that under the Freedom of Information Scotland Act, FOISA, then housing associations are caught in Scotland, but currently the ruling in England and Wales, presumably, is that they're not caught. So I think it depends, you know, whether you're caught by the Scottish Freedom of Information Act or the England and Wales Freedom of Information Act as to whether you're caught. Again, it's all that adding a heck of a lot of confusion, isn't it, to the situation.
It'd be rather awkward if you're a housing association on one side of the border with properties on the other.
Yeah. Ollie, you're awfully quiet.
Yes, I am awfully quiet because I was looking at these statistics published by Scottish authorities.
Yeah, I can't.
On their request.
Journey away.
Yeah, you generate a CSV file and have a look through that.
It is
rather interesting, particularly some of the things that you can look at. But also, I think it's worth pointing out on this whole point around housing providers being caught, obviously, the elephant in the room, so to speak, is that this white paper's on the table for the access to information scheme for housing providers in England. So that could all change from a freedom of information perspective. I don't think there's set to be, well, there's not a huge amount of information about it currently, but I don't think it's set to include a practice publication scheme. I think it's just about being able to access information.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's making housing associations subject to provision of information, but it doesn't put them on the FOIA. I don't think it puts them on Schedule 1.
That's right. But I think it creates a substantially similar power, I believe. But I say, I think it's all up in the air, to be honest, at the minute, because only a white paper published, and I don't think there's been any more than that, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I mean, there's some quite substantial differences. My experience is that local authorities tend to have, seem to have, the ones we work with, the governance team that deals with, overall, the Freedom of Information, EIR, and GDPR requests. But then they have within that, you know, specialists who are dealing with Freedom of Information. But you often get very complex requests coming in that span departments. Therefore, you've got to. It's the same process, isn't it, for handling all these requests? You get a request in, you screen it. You know, the screening for EIR and for FOIA requests are manifestly unreasonable rather than unfounded or vexatious. With the Freedom of Information Act, I think there's a cost limit. So you could say, well, we're not responding to this because responding will overrun the cost limit. Which I think there's two tiers. Central government, I think, is £600, and any other government department.
£450, I think.
£450 for other authorities, but central government is £600. And there's an hourly rate in there of £25 due to calculate the costs of complying. But again, then you get into the complications. So certain tasks can be costed in to FOIA requests. But not for EIRs, the other way around. And you can charge for a reasonable charge for making information available under the EIRs, but you can charge for locating, retrieving, data under the FOIA, but not for providing it, I don't think. So each of these regimes has got a slightly different set of complications. You can raise verbal requests under EIR and under the GDPR, obviously, but not under the FOIA. They've got to be in written requests. So, you know, we've got some teams here having to contend with, you know, a request comes in, what is this? You know, let's say it's a very complicated one. You know, there's a duty to help people, isn't there, to sort out their request and to make sure it's answerable effectively. And it could be that it spans the EIR, the FOIA, and might include personal data and you know, there's planning consent and things like that might
well, I think, yeah, I mean, I quite like that duty to kind of help, isn't it, within the FOIA and the IR kind of going, if you kind of submitted and it doesn't quite meet the validity, I've got to go back and tell you how to submit a valid request under FOIA. And I quite like that as a kind of a stance to take. You can certainly take that with details, couldn't you, in the sense that you're actually saying, we recognise this is a right and we're giving effect to the fact that it's a right. And you're trying to exercise your right, but it's not quite there. What you need to do is this, in that kind of sense. So I do quite like that kind of approach to supporting individuals with the management of their rights. Very similarly, if you look conversely about other offences about withholding rights or withholding from disclosure, certainly the offence under the Data Protection Act, if you're doing it with details and you deliberately try to avoid or take action to avoid information being disclosed to a debtor subject under there. And there was with the FOIA as well, there was that case with the Whitchurch Town Council. I don't know if you remember that case where they intentionally blocked records to avoid disclosure. Was it around CCTV or something or other? So some recordings anyway, but they were aware of the recordings and they were aware of the request, but they then later decided to delete the recording. So she was
The client got fined, didn't she?
She did, yeah. She got prosecuted under Section 77 of FOIA.
Yeah.
For deliberate withholding. And now you've certainly got that with the DPA as well, haven't you, with the section, what was it, 172 or something like that, I think it is, under Data Protection Act.
Yeah. Why do you think there's a difference then between the FOIA where you as a publication scheme that has to be maintained? I'd look at the ICO's publication scheme. It's actually quite interesting to look at their publication scheme and then have a drill down into what documentation is part of that publication scheme. So there's the requirement to do that under the FOIA, but not under the EIR. There's obviously a requirement there to keep and organise environmental information. And you know, disseminate actively and systematically, but it's not quite the same, is it? It's not quite the same as the defined publication scheme. Actually, they've changed that, haven't they, as well? So in the past, there was a, you know, and they've now got model schemes, haven't they, rather than, you know, it's a bit more open, I think, from memory in the past.
Yeah, I think that's possibly just because, like I said earlier, just with the root, isn't it? So FOIA came out in 2000 and a UK piece of law. The AR regulation itself came from an EU directive in around about 2004. So it's possibly just differences from origin, I would have thought, possibly.
Yeah, and you've got 20 days to comply, haven't you? 20 working days to comply to both of those types of requests. But with the EIR, you can extend for a further 20 working days for various reasons. So again, they're consistent at least, almost, but not consistent with the GDPR, where you've got a month.
Well, it's not too dissimilar, is it? Because 20 working days and a month of non-working days and non-working days,
yeah, I guess
probably
so.
More or less the same.
Yeah, you're probably right, actually. I've not thought of it like that.
So, yeah, I mean, 20 working days will give you a short month, wouldn't it? You've got 31 days and 5 weeks in 1 month because of the way the days fall. But it'd be more or less the same, isn't it? On an average month, is about 20 working days.
Yeah, and it's interesting that emissions information has got a special status under the EIRs, and you can't withhold that. I tell you what's also really interesting, again, difference in the two regimes, is that under the EIR, there's an obligation to provide copies of documents, but of course there isn't under the FOIA or under the GDPR. It's just it's just information that's to be made available.
Cheers, yeah, I noticed that, yeah. It's and the difficulty, I think, for organisations that are caught by all three would be, I think, as you alluded to earlier, would be identifying, well, what request have I got? and what the if I pursue it under EIRs, well, what does that mean, and how do I comply with that? And if it's a 4-year, then what does that mean? How do I comply with that? Because of the slight nuances between the two rights.
Yeah, and there's a historical cutoff. Historical records aren't caught by the FOIA, but there's no historical kind of threshold with the EIR. So again, there are quite a few differences, aren't there? And I guess if you're heading up a team looking at information, you know, rights requests across all three of these different legislative regimes, then you know, you've got to be across it, and I guess you've got to have the rest of your team across it. Because when you start getting to the use of exemptions, so we found this information, now we want to start thinking about applying exemptions, then again, there's a whole range of different exemptions that each of these three regimes can rely on.
For sure, there certainly seem to be quite a few exemptions in FOIA, running what between sections 21 and 41, I think it is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, is there? I mean, which ones do you generally, you know, come across the most, Dave? When you're working with clients, do you get asked about these things? I mean, often we get asked about information held by third parties, you know, and commercially sensitive information. That's one that often comes up, isn't it?
It does. That's quite an interesting one as well, to be fair, because that differs as well under the AII, if I remember rightfully. Because FOIA, if you're predominantly holding information on behalf of somebody else, then it's not caught by FOIA regulations. So if you're a council literally just holding onto it for somebody, then it's kind of outside of FOIA. But the EIR is about the information held. I was just reading some information from the ICO on that earlier, that kind of highlighted the fact that the ICO's view is different to what the EIR regulations actually state, but that the regulations do not exclude information that you hold solely on behalf of another person or organisations, because the regulation says any information in your possession that you've produced or received is caught by the EIR. But the ICO thinks that's probably a bit too strict, and therefore you've got to be holding it to the extent for your own purposes for it to be caught by the EIR regulations. So yeah. I found that quite interesting as well, just with the differences there.
And you know, one of the fascinating areas about the EIR is the information it covers. You know, the what is considered to be environmental information. So, you know, information about the state of the element. Do you remember doing this in your masters? Yeah. The state of the elements of the environment, such as the air, the atmosphere, water, soil, land, landscape, blah 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 blah. So, you know, there's an awful lot, and that's why I was amazed that utilities companies, and there's quite a lot of exempted companies. You think, why? How can a utilities company be exempt from the EIR when what they do is they clean water, they take water, they clean water, they pump water back into the environment. Why would they be exempt? Bizarre.
Oh, absolutely. Or even if you're developing an environmental site for a utility company, and you're digging up local fauna, for example, that's got some protected plant species or something in there, that would be caught by the you can submit an EIR request. So, well, what are you going to do about protecting that kind of information in that sense? So it would seem absolutely nuts that they're not, on the sense that they would appear more caught than house associations, wouldn't you? But the I would have honestly thought that the utility companies were.
Yeah, it's strange. I've just noticed in the time, I think somehow we've managed to not really talk about much, but run out of time almost. But oh, hang on, somebody's correcting me here. English Water Company not exempt. I thought that there's a decision that United Utilities were exempt, but I'd have to double check that. You're probably right, Andy. I'm sure you've got. I'm sure you're probably right.
I didn't think there were. Unless it's old information, I didn't think there were, but we can still go back and check.
Yeah, I thought there were not covered by it. But Andy, if he's been there and had to, you know, do the job and sit in the hot seat, then he's probably got more up to date information.
Oh no, absolutely. I'm not debating. It's just when I looked at it, I thought there was this thing about them being exempt. So by all means, unmute and join in. It's your session as much as ours. So if you've got points to raise, and please do join in. But I thought that was the case previously. But I'm more than happy to be stand corrected on that. It's not an area that I'm working regularly with for you and EIRs.
Yeah. I was interested, Ollie, that pharmacy to you were caught. There was a decision notice actually issued against pharmacy to you a couple of years ago, and they were deemed to be caught by several parts of a request for information made on the FOIA. They were deemed to be caught by the FOIA under several sections of that request and not others. So that was interesting. I guess it was a pharmaceutical business providing medicines, then caught, but I hadn't noticed that they had a decision notice in the past, to be honest.
No, that is interesting. That is interesting. I'd assume that all the aspects which interact with the NHS presumably would have been
caught.
Repeat prescriptions and such. No, that is interesting.
Right. Okay. So I'm not sure we've covered the topic in particular depth or to a particularly good level, but we're now at 27 minutes past. We're probably running out of time. What else should we be covering off, Ollie? What was the aim to have a look at these three things. But I mean, really, the essence is that what we've got is a process for receiving these, recognizing these, finding out which law they are raised under, then applying the preliminary qualifications, and then doing information search, and that might involve multiple departments across a local authority, then gathering all the information together. I mean, they're very similar processes, and then sifting through it, and in some cases providing documents, in some cases providing information. Applying exemptions, commonality, not common. So, a high degree of training involved. We're very used to training people in the SARS, but not so much in these exemptions, are we? But if you've got one multidisciplinary team doing, all three types of requests, then I would have thought regular training is required to ensure that in my mind I probably would start mixing them up if I was doing this day in day out, and I would be wanting to put regular training in place and testing people's knowledges, and then of course there's the disclosure piece. But there's actually an awful lot of decision notices that the ICO is called to make on certainly the FOIA. It seems like there's lots of times that local authorities, the public authorities, get the decisions wrong, make the wrong call. I'm amazed how many decision notices there are, to be honest. But there we go. So listen, we've probably run out of time. Is there anything we need to cover off additionally?
Well, I guess if we're looking at it, we could have dug into some of the exemptions, couldn't we? Looking at because there's class-based exemptions and prejudice-based exemptions, and what that might look like. We maybe add that for another time. Just looking at the clock purely because I've got a meeting to join at 1:30. Yeah. So we've got and where you can use this ability to neither confirm or deny where information is sensitive. Where it may be held by an exemption. So there's a range of exemptions and bits and pieces that we could have maybe dug into that are quite interesting in the way they're applied.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have to put another session on to get specifically into those exemptions. Because again, that's what we've done with the SAR sessions we've run. We've talked high level, and then we've talked in detail about the actual exemptions themselves, haven't we?
Yeah, because you've got things like the prejudice test. We're not kind of going into it. You've got things about whether if it's prejudice based exemption, you've got the prejudice test. So then you have to go through what prejudice test is and that kind of stuff. So it's so I think we could certainly have another talk about it, another point to cover off it a little bit more in depth, I would have thought.
Yeah, well let's do that. What are you doing this week? Next week, sorry.
I need to get to the part of the day where I look forward to next week.
Have you been doing lots of training this week?
I've done lots of training this week for sure, with different housing associations. I was just trying to think what else this week had involved. Catching up on action plans, delivering on looking at system DPIAs. And just quickly, because we really need to jump, looking at system DPIAs and actually kind of looking at three or four aspects purely around system DPIAs. So, for example, maybe a housing management system, and looking at how is it configured, and is it configured correctly around role-based permissions? Do you know what it can do? Do you know what it can't do? Have you switched things on? That sometimes links over to an issue I had with 365, an email through 365 accounts where people have access to DLP, but they've just not turned it on. In that sense, so if you have a data loss to an email going astray, that could have been stopped because you've got the kit to do it, but you just didn't action it in that sense. And then looking at, in addition to that, training around the system use, because another bit of a bugbear of mine through previous walks of life is you kind of go, there's your login details, there's your username, there's your login details, off you pop, and there's no kind of real kind of training or awareness on the system, or alternatively, the system was brought in 25 years ago and has been a version of Chinese Whisper since. And you kind of have a mismatch approach to training on the system. So when I've done root cause analyses for organizations to kind of figure out, well, what went wrong, individuals kind of going, well, I thought this was what I'm meant to be doing. I'm sure this was the approach I was shown, because there's no guides, there's no user notes, there's no training, the training's not logged. And in addition to that, there's function creep setting in with how documents are used or how processes are used around that bit of kit. So it's been interesting teasing some of those out this week.
Yeah. What are you doing next week, Ollie?
Oh, what am I not doing next week? I've got plenty on as ever. I'm in the midst of a supplier task for a client reviewing their processes.
I'll just apologise to John. Yeah, I'm going to have to jump on this meeting. So thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you, Dave. Catch you
later.
Take care
now. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Take care, mate. Yeah, and then I've got a bunch of DPIAs actually on the spin, somewhat like Dave, but instead of looking at systems, I'm assessing some of the products of my clients, including an app that's about to be launched, which should be quite interesting. Right. But yeah, that's primarily what I'm into right now.
All right. Well, my aim next week, I've got 4 days off because I'm going to try and help my son change the gearbox on his Mini. I have to say, I hate doing mechanical type stuff. But we've borrowed a friend's barn. He's got a car lift. He's really into his old cars, is my mate Harry. So he's got a car lift in his barn and a fully kitted out workshop. So actually, I'm quite looking forward to that, which will be change of scene. But we'll see how we get on.
Yeah, chalk and cheese there. What I'm
doing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I'll be back next Friday. You'll be very pleased to know, or maybe not.
No, good, good.
Right. So, sorry we've run out of time, but I think there is plenty to be had by having another session and getting into a bit more detail, because there's an awful lot to these regulations and they affect different organisations. So, again, if that's something we'll slot into the calendar, we'll do that in the future. But thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for all the comments, some really good comments on the chat. We haven't covered them all off, but a lot of people have been chatting amongst themselves and answering their own questions. So thank you, Ollie. Thanks also to Dave, who's jumped off. Have a great weekend, and we'll hopefully see you next week.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Take care, everyone. Yeah.